Session number 1746,
Reel 3. Commander Barton, Reel 3.
As I was saying, it was a great day for the Navy and a blow for freedom that we were actually allowed to smoke that day in the dining hall. Never been known before, and I'm sure never since. Survivor's leave went 14 days, and then back into the sausage machine. Of course, I was already recommended for a higher gunnery rate, so I went straight into the gunnery school. I always wanted to be a gunner, basically a gunnery officer.
Before we take it any further, if I can go back to one incident you described in the actions off Norway,
yeah.
That was your brush with the Scharnhorst.
Yes.
Can you tell me what it was like in action? Because this would have been the first time you were in real action.
Yes.
Because we've both been watching recently the film Sink the Bismarck,
yeah.
In which naval action and Royal Navy personnel are shown in a very stiff upper lip way.
Yeah. Yes, I saw the same picture, the Sink the Bismarck, and to me it was something unreal, because there was no. We were told the Scharnhorst, we saw her on the horizon there. She looked massive, she looked colossal, we saw them. And when they fired, the thing was, it was almost obliterated by a sheet of flame. Knowing the size of her armament and the normal accuracy of German gunners, I don't think there were any stiff upper lips, certainly not on my gun or number four gun. And when we saw the sheet of flame which came from her ship's side, although she said she was on the horizon, we saw, you could still see this. And then the tremendous whirr as the shells passed overhead and landed, they were pitching very close around us there. Column of water, 60, 70, 80 feet high. Huge shells exploding with a greeny-grey explosion with a flash in the middle. And it seemed to me to be, when the picture was made, that the officers were so laid back, it was impossible. There was nothing, no human instincts, no normal expressions used. They worked strictly to a script to show the British, the standard British naval officer, in what a standard British naval officer is supposed to be. I didn't see this aboard Hardy. I saw officers in every type and every sort of behaviour. I saw some with very stiff upper lips, and I saw some with very shaky, and actually stiff upper lips disappearing quicker than that. I'm not decrying their standard of leadership, but it certainly didn't in any way, shape or form apply on the film that I saw then, Sink the Bismarck. They must have been a different class of people, because they weren't like my officers and they weren't like my men. So I can't. I don't fully subscribe to the spectacles I saw there, and I don't, knowing the German sailors as I know them, I know them now as I knew them then from the Mediterranean, as I know them now. I take a great exception to the light in which they were portrayed. I've no time for it at all. They were no better, no different, no braver, no more cowardly than our own people. They were ordinary common or garden sailors, exactly like me. And I just don't subscribe to a lot of the pictures, a lot of the films that were made. That and the Battle of the Plate, I'm afraid I don't. I just cannot agree with it.
How does fear, when the shells are coming over, affect one's competence in doing one's job aboard ship?
Well, to my recollection, it didn't, because we were so trained. Call it brainwashed. We saw what we do. There's a hole in the end of the gun. You put a shell in it. You put a cartridge behind it. You close the breech, and somebody pulls the trigger or presses the pedal. You do it so automatically that it's not until afterwards when you think that whirring that went over could have been a 15-inch shell, and you think, Christ, what would that have done to this gun deck? It would have torn a ship in two. So actually, at the time, I cannot honestly say that I felt afraid, because things happen so fast, and it's like looking at a picture anyway. You don't get time, you don't get... The adrenaline certainly is flowing when they say the enemy's in sight, and they say it is Sharnos and Gleis. Now, well, I was on a 1,500-ton destroyer, which is a little bit wee compared to that size. But knowing the fact that we were the Royal Navy anyway, and there was no question about who was going to win any battle that we took part in, which we really believed, you know, believe it or not, it didn't affect us at all. And it certainly, I never saw any instance, apart from one when we were actually almost ready to abandon ship, when one young sailor hesitated to go round the front of the gun and fetch his shell. But when I pointed out, go on quicker than that, and he did it without any hesitation. But all he wanted was a gentle nudge. I saw no evidences of any betrayal of their nature at all. It looked like something that happened in a picture. We were taking part in.
You were telling me about, to go back to something even earlier, you were telling me about contact with the German Navy before war was declared.
Yes.
What was your attitude towards the German Navy in those days?
We found them great people. They were so very much like us. They liked beer, they liked football. They liked all the common sailors' failings, if you like, and we found them great people to be with. We certainly had no animosity, and they've told me, and I believe them. They were sincere. They told me that they were in Wilhelmshaven aboard these ships when they heard the news that we had declared war, and that England, Britain, and Germany were now at war. And they said then that they were in tears on the mess deck, because they knew from that day, the news from day one, that there was no way they were going to beat us. They knew it. They knew that we would just keep coming, and whatever we had, that we would keep coming and coming and coming until they just couldn't do it anymore. And they were quite convinced. The German Navy were quite convinced. German sailors that I've come across were quite convinced that no way were they going to win. Some of their officers might have had different ideas. I don't know. I've met one or two officers who still, at the time, who still, I feel, were... died in the wool Nazi officers. Some of the comments they've made and that I'd heard, they didn't really like us, and they didn't like the thought that they were highly trained naval officers and they'd been beaten to a standstill. But generally speaking, the naval officers and the naval ratings that I found to be actually 100% people, and I admire them tremendously. The ships they had to fight with were bigger ships than ours, but they were very, very poor sea boats. The conditions under which they live compared to us were rough, because their ships were not intended for long voyages. They were not intended to be lived aboard. When they come into harbour, they close the ship down, they leave watchkeepers aboard, and they tie up to all the dockyard supplies. They don't have watchkeepers on board as stokers, engineers. They put all the services onto shorelines, so they're not intended to live aboard. So this means that their comfort on board is virtually nil. And that we were expected, of course, to take a destroyer and travel around the world for 2.5 years each commission, with what we had in a kit bag and a hammock. So this was a different navy, but I found them people that I had a great respect for, and a great admiration, a great liking for too, I must say.
Which Germans told you about Wilhelmshaven on the 3rd of September 1939?
This shield, which I've got here, is an actual Narvik shield, which was given to one of the sailors aboard the Erich Giza. And he's sent it to me. He is now a captain in the water police on the German waterways, Heinrich Palmer. And he sent me this as a memento. He carried it sewn in the seat of his trousers or in the bottom of his kit bag from the time he was taken prisoner, some another year or so after Narvik, he was taken prisoner on a German blockade runner which was sunk off the coast of South America by the American Air Force. And he sent me this Narvik shield. And as I said, he had to fight hard to keep it, but he finished up actually as a prisoner of war in Manchester. And he still thinks Manchester United are the greatest. A fine man, and I met him, and been to his home and met his wife. He's a lovely chap. But they were the Erich Geiser was the ship that led the three destroyers down the fjord, who came out of Herjungsfjord, and the captain was then was Max Eckhart Wolf. He finished up, he retired not long ago as a rear admiral, Counter Admiral Max Eckhart Wolf. E-C-K-H-A-R-T, Eckhart Wolf, W-O-L-F-E, with a circumflex on the O. And I've met him since. And I remember one conversation I had with the admiral, with Max Wolf. And it turns out he said he'd heard about me firing Hardy's gun, and he said, "Doug, you were firing at me, and I was firing at you." And I said, "That's correct, Max." He said, "It's a good thing we both bloody bad shots," which I thought was just about shows the complete idiocy, the complete inanity of the whole thing that we were engaged in. But I also have this other shield here, which was it came about in a strange way. It shows the. This was from Herbert Reiss, who was aboard the Wolfgang Zinker. He's got his destroyer badge, which they wore on their left breast, the Narvik shield, and the Iron Cross, which he won for laying mines in the Thames Estuary in 1939. And we both had heart attacks in the same week, and we both wrote to each other and commiserated that we couldn't attend. And he sent, as a present, he sent me, mounted these on this oak shield, and sent them to me for me to pass on to my family, as he said, because he had lost his wife during the Russian occupation. And they're magnificent things. The shield shows the destroyer cutting through the gold ring of laurels, and the Narvik shield shows the anchor for the seamen, the propeller for the stokers, and the Edelweiss, because every one of the destroyers took 250 of the Jäger battalions, that is the German crack troops, up to Narvik. So altogether they took 2,500 German soldiers aboard them. There it is there, with the swastika above it. And they thought enough of us to send these as they said, not me, they said, as a token of their admiration of the fact that we got up into Narvik at all under the conditions under which existed at the time, snow, blackness, and to arrive up there and then proceed to carry out and do the damage we did with five of us, not the war spite, but they admired us for doing this. It also saddens me that the fact that when we went to Narvik, we were wearing our medals, wearing our decorations of war medals, and we were called to task by a Norwegian commander who asked why we weren't wearing the Norwegian war medal. And I pointed out that we'd never been given it. He said, "You were." He said, "Because I was one of the officers who arranged for the presentation of the medals." So I said, "Well, we haven't got them." He said, "Well, your officers have got them." Which surprised us, and it turned out that the Admiralty, for some reason or other, refused us to be granted this against the wishes of the Norwegian people, for some reason best known to themselves. But when it was taken up with the Norwegian embassy again, they made provision for the presentation of the medal at a service in 1981 at Westminster Abbey, when they came over to visit us, the Norwegians who took part at Narvik. And arrangements had been made for the medals to be presented by the Norwegian ambassador after the service, a joint service at the Abbey. And again it was refused for some reason best known to the Ministry of Defence. All sorts of silly stories have been put up about British sailors not being given foreign decorations, but the actual Norwegian people, the people of Narvik, resent this very much because Hardy was first into Narvik. Hardy sank the ship, the Wilhelm Heidkamp, that had sunk the Norge and the Eidsvold, which were the two German ships at the start of the fjord. This was the previous day, of course. We had no knowledge of this at the time.
The two Norwegian ships.
The Norwegian ships, you see, the Norwegian Eidsvold and Norge. N-O-R-G-E, Eidsvold, E-I-S-F-O-L-D, Eidsvold. We'd avenged the sinking of the ships. And we struck the first blows for the freedom of Norway. And they resented bitterly that we were not allowed to take it. I don't know what's happened since, but I know representations have been made, but I doubt it, knowing the Ministry of Defence and their complete obdurate attitude. You'll never beat the Admiralty or the MODN. It just can't happen. So that we say it's, as far as I'm concerned, the matter's closed. But it does seem a great shame at the time, because they've made all these provision for the Narvik survivors, the Hardy survivors, to be presented with the Norwegian War Medal, which I thought was small enough in all context. Still, that's beside the point.
Can we pick up your personal story now with the way you left off, which was with you being promoted in the gunnery side?
Yes. Well, we went, as I said, we went to the gunnery school, and then I met, by chance, in barracks, I met a friend of mine, who was another seaman, who'd been a boy seaman with me, on the warspite, and I asked him where he was off, and he said, well, I'm going to motor torpedo boats, motor gunboats. I said, you are? I said, what? Tell me something about it. So anyway, he told me, and he said, I'm going as coxswain. I said, right. So I went down to the drafting office, applied, and within a fortnight I was on my way to motor torpedo boats. We went to the HMS Attack at Portland, which was the MTB depot at the time, and I did my coxswain's course of about a month or 6 weeks, which meant not only the handling of small craft, which I was already proficient at as a leading seaman, but also in the regulations and victualling, all the Naval Discipline Act and the whole thing, because as coxswain you virtually run the ship for the first lieutenant. You look after the whole thing. I was also proficient in gunnery and that sort of thing, so it didn't make any difference, gunnery and torpedo work. I did a short course in torpedoes at Defiance, which was the torpedo school. Anyway, in the end I qualified as coxswain of Coastal Forces. I was drafted, when I finished my course, to motor gunboat 62, MGB 62, which was a 70-foot wooden motor gunboat made at Scott Payne's on the Solent, at a place called Hythe. These were brand new design boats, powered by three Rolls-Royce Merlin Spitfire engines. Their armament was not all that heavy. We had 0.5 machine gun turrets and twin turrets, bolt and pole defined turrets. And then we had a small aircraft turret at the rear and stern. And they were not all that well armed, but at least they were war vessels. The armament was changed very, very quickly when we found out what we were up against, but I'm afraid we suffered a few casualties before they got them. Anyway, we were formed up into a flotilla, and we went to sea. After some months, we went to sea from the Solent, and unfortunately, on our first trip, we were at sea in conditions which were completely and utterly unsuitable for small craft of that nature. But of course we were all enthusiastic, young, enthusiastic officers, almost entirely RNBR, wartime officers with very little skill or very little knowledge, unfortunately, of the sea. There's a difference in handling a 20-foot yacht and a 70-foot motor gunboat with three 1500 horse Merlin engines sticking you along at 25, 30, 35, 40 knots. So I'm afraid the boats got knocked about badly, and their crews did too. In fact, one of my trips out at sea, we were at sea, as I said, in conditions, atrocious conditions, and I was flung off the wheel. We as they say, hit a milestone, we hit a wave which stopped us in our tracks, flung me off the wheel, and I finished up with a broken spine in the deck of the wheelhouse.
When was this?
This was in 1941.
Beginning of?
Yes, the beginning of February, yes, February 41. It was a very difficult situation because I was lying on the, I'm not a tiny person. I was lying on the deck of the wheelhouse, which is a small wheelhouse, and somehow I had to get out of that into the rear of the wheelhouse, which was the sort of a whaleback cover, and then be lifted through a hatchway. And eventually I was too big for them to lift, so I had to climb out on my elbows with a crushed second lumbar vertebrae, which was quite an exciting trip. And eventually they hauled me out anyway. To cut a long story short, I went to hospital. It had been this time, it was around about the Blitz time in Southampton, and things were in a dreadful state, and they sent a Morris 8 driven by a wren who'd probably dissolved into tears when she saw the state I was in. I wasn't far off it myself at the time. And with the help of a dockyard policeman, I was coiled down in the rear. Now this, of course, with a broken spine. I was coiled down somewhere across the front and down the rear of a Morris 8, smaller than a Morris Minor, and she drove me. I couldn't lay down. I had my rear portion just about sticking out of the window on the left-hand side. This poor little girl had to drive me all the way to Southants Hospital, where they put me on a trolley and left me for the best part of a day. I think they didn't think they'd have to bother with me much longer. But anyway, I went to the hospital and they plastered me up and sent me to Hasler Hospital. And it came the day, of course, then. They said, right, oh, you can walk now. I'm going to send you on a month's leave. And I protested strongly at this because in no way could my mother or my family look after me in that condition. But so I refused to go on leave, you see. Which wasn't a very clever thing to do, because I had to see, I finished up by having to see the, I've never been the lower deck lawyer type of person, but I didn't want to go on leave. And I thought it only right that the Navy, having done this, should look after me and send me anywhere, but not send me on leave. I was in no condition. I could sort of put one foot in front of the other slowly, but I was in no condition to walk around. So I objected, and they sent me to see the orthopedic specialist, who was a rear admiral of the old Navy type. Very long, long grey sideboards, and the old-fashioned sip it, sit up and beg collar, and a lovely old man. Called back to the war, but he was an orthopedic specialist and he knew his stuff, so he sat me down in his office and pointed out the error of my ways. And I said, well, what's going to happen? He said, well, if you don't go on leave, he said, we'll have to keep you here. He said, then when we get refit, we'll court-martial you. So I said, well, I don't want that. He said, no, he said, we don't want it either. He said, so why don't you go on leave like a good boy? So, reluctantly, not wanting to argue with the rear admiral and compound a felony, I went on leave. And naval care then was not as it is now, and they took me to the regulating office and gave me my warrant, and they gave me what they thought was adequate pay for a month's leave, victualling allowance. So with my attaché case and my only clothes, the only thing I could put on, I had a complete body plaster and a white sweater. I had a spare white sweater and some odds and ends of uniform in my kit and a little attaché case. They wouldn't give me a walking stick because they said it wouldn't do. So I said, right, off I went. They put me at the gate of Hasler Barracks and I walked and walked and eventually got a bus into Fareham. And I walked some more and eventually got to Fareham station, and I got a train for Bristol, which stopped at every station between Fareham, which is near Southampton or Portsmouth, and Bristol. It was a long, long trip. I eventually got to Bristol, by which time I was in a state of collapse, and a young lady very kindly saw me. I was in this state. I don't know if she thought I was drunk enough, but she sat me down and she went and got me one of the In those days there were shorter cups, so they used to drink out of jam jars, and she got me a pound jam jar full of tea from the Women's Voluntary Association or some such other. Eventually she brought me round and she took me to the station, took me over the station to the South Wales train, and sat me in a compartment, wished me good luck, and away I went. So when I got to Newport, somebody else helped me out of the train at Newport, and somebody took me along to, I don't know, I haven't got a clue who took me along, it wasn't me anyway, I couldn't have done it, took me along and put me on a train for the valleys. Now I was all right here because the train didn't go any further than Ebbw Vale, which is my hometown. So off I went up the valleys, and of course when I came home now I had about something like a mile and a half, which was nearly being Wales of course, all uphill. So about an hour and a half after the last train had arrived, by which time everybody sort of, nobody knew I was coming home, but they didn't think, I didn't expect anything to happen in the village or the town, I eventually sort of fell through the door. As I said, naval medicine now isn't the same as it was then, thank God. Anyway, I got back on my feet. I did all the proper things. I wanted to go back to sea. So I got back into barracks. I got to, eventually after being discharged from hospital, I did a couple of weeks of physiotherapy, and they said, are you all right now? Fit for sea? I went, yes, lied frantically, and I saw the doctors and bulled my way through all the medical examinations and lied frantically, as I said, and eventually I was drafted back into general service to barracks, where I promptly pointed out that I was in the wrong place, that I'd already been drafted to coastal forces, and they said, oh yes, so you should. So they sent me back to coastal forces, MTBs. So I went back to Portsmouth, and before long I was on another motor gunboat.
When was this?
This was the same year. This was the same year in 1941.
End of
1941, yes. I went to a motor gunboat, then number MGB-9, working the second motor gunboat flotilla at Dover. And there we joined up with the second MGBs, and we operated through the winter onto... we did motor gunboat runs, we did mine laying runs, quite a number of fights with E-boats and R-boats, nothing of any real importance, but we did the normal MTB work. And then one in MGB-9, I'm not sure what it was, I think it was a distant mine which we detonated, but the trouble was, I was still, without telling anybody, I don't think I was a hero at all, but I just liked the boat side, like it's a better, it was where I wanted to be. But on this occasion we went over or near or past a mine, an acoustic, or it could have been one of ours, I don't know, which exploded, but it didn't damage the boat apart from a general shake up and every rivet was strained, but it took a bit of water in over the around in the bilges, but nothing of any importance. But I got flung off the wheel sideways.